Hello, ladies and gentlemen, this is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am covering in this audio Joshua chapter 22, verses 1 through 34, the eastern tribes return home. Our context is this, in the previous several chapters, starting back in Joshua 14 all the way up to Joshua 21, we see the land divvied up, the boundaries, the cities, and so forth. We see the inheritance for sisters that have no brothers taken care of with the daughters of Zelophehad. We see the Levites taken care of with their 48 cities and the 42 cities and the six cities of refuge. All of that's been taken care of. And so now we start in Joshua 22, verses 1 and 2. Then Joshua summoned the Reubenites and the Gadites and the half-tribe of Manasseh and said to them, "You have kept all that Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded you, and have listened to my voice and all that I commanded you." Well, the Lord commanded the Israelites, and Joshua commanded the Israelites. Or I should say, the Lord commanded the 2.5 tribes, the Reubenites, the Gadites, and half Manasseh. Now, where did the Lord command those 2.5 tribes? Numbers 32, verses 1 through 42. We can read that. I won't read that. Let me see what Gill says about that. The command that, quote, that they should leave their wives and children and flocks and herds, and behind them in the land of Gilead, and pass over Jordan, with their brethren the children of Israel armed, and fight with them, and for them, until the Canaanites were subdued, and not return until their brethren were peaceably settled in the possession of their inheritances. So, the 2.5 tribes had done that. They had gone over the Jordan, fought, and now they want to go back. And it was 7 years they fought, a long time. And also they have listened to Joshua's voice, my voice, Joshua says, and all that I commanded you. Well, Gill says, this is what Joshua commanded them. What rank and position to be in? What part to take in an engagement? What attack to make? When and where? Or on what expedition to go? Wherever he ordered them to go, they went. And upon whatsoever and wheresoever he sent them, they readily and cheerfully obeyed as they promised. We read in Joshua 1, verses 16 and 17, they answered Joshua, saying, all that you have commanded us we will do, and wherever you send us we will go. Just as we obeyed Moses in all things, so we will obey you. Only may the Lord your God be with you as he was with Moses. The they that's talking to Joshua and saying, we've obeyed you, that's referring to the 2.5 tribes. Joshua 1, verses 16 and 17. Now, this obedience to God and to Moses and to Joshua, this obedience was done despite the fact that there was only the River Jordan between them and their families. Remember, they left their families behind on the east side of the Jordan in order to go fight on the west side. And for 7 years, they left their families over there. And they didn't return home, even though they could have easily crossed the Jordan. The Jordan was easily fordable at all times except the harvest. They could have easily gone back, and they didn't. We go now to Joshua 22, verses 3 through 5. Joshua continues, praising the 2.5 tribes. You have not forsaken your brothers these many days to this day, but have kept the charge of the commandment of the Lord your God. And now the Lord your God has given rest to your brothers, as he spoke to them. Therefore, turn now and go to your tents, to the land of your possession, which Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave you beyond the Jordan. Only be very careful to observe the commandment and the law which Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded you, to love the Lord your God and walk in all his ways and keep his commandments and hold fast to him and serve him with all your heart and with all your soul. Now Joshua uses that word rest in verse 4. Now the Lord your God has given rest to your brothers. Rest means we finish fighting the war, and that has become a standard stock metaphor for the rest that we Christians receive when we enter into the promised land, the kingdom. In other words, rest is a type, the antitype of which is our entrance into the Church of Christ. We see that word rest in Joshua 21, verse 44, the previous chapter, and the Lord gave them rest on every side, according to all that he had sworn to their fathers, and no one of all their enemies stood before them. The Lord gave all their enemies into their hand, and so when we enter into rest, that means all of our enemies are in our hand. God has won every battle for us. All we have to do is walk in it. Of course, most of the battles are against our internal sin, but we have victory over that. We have rest over all our enemies. We also have external enemies too, of course. God gives us victory over those external enemies also. In Deuteronomy 12, 9 and 10, we read this, "For you have not as yet come to the resting place and the inheritance which the Lord your God has given you. When you cross the Jordan and live in the land which the Lord your God is giving you to inherit, and he gives you rest from all your enemies around so that you live in security." So the promised land is rest, And that's a perfect type for the Christian's rest in the kingdom. Hebrews 4:3, first part of the verse, "For we who have believed enter the rest." For we who have believed enter the rest. Now Joshua in verse 5 says this, "Only be very careful to observe the commandment." And he goes on and on about hold fast to him with all your heart and with all your soul, walk in his ways. Why was Joshua especially so strong to remind them of this at this point? Well, because the 2.5 tribes were at a distance from the tabernacle altar and service of God and might be under temptation to relinquish it and set up another form of worship elsewhere. And as we'll see in the sequel to this, in this chapter, that's exactly what the 9.5 tribes feared. The fear manifested itself in a breach that almost led to a civil war, or could have led to a civil war. We go now to Joshua 22, verses 6 through 8. "So Joshua blessed them and sent them away, and they went to their tents. Now to the 1/2 tribe of Manasseh, Moses had given a possession in Bashan, but to the other half, Joshua gave a possession among their brothers westward beyond the Jordan. So when Joshua sent them away to their tents, he blessed them and said to them, 'Return to your tents with great riches and with very much livestock, with silver, gold, bronze, iron, and with very many clothes. Divide the spoil of your enemies with your brothers.'" So Joshua blessed the 2.5 tribes there at Shiloh. Of course, they went away to their tents. That would be their military tents there, not their homes on the east side of the Jordan, but back where they were staying on the west side of the Jordan near Shiloh. Shiloh, of course, is the northern part, central part of Ephraim. And then verse 7 seems almost parenthetical. "Now to the 1/2 tribe of Manasseh, Moses gave a portion to the east in Bashan, east of the Sea of Galilee, and another portion to the west of the Jordan." Why did he single out Manasseh that way? Well, I think it was because that was the only tribe that was on both sides of the River Jordan. And John Gill suggests that Joshua needed to emphasize that, to especially mention that, so that plunder could be shared with both halves of the tribes. The plunder that they had gotten from conquering Israel would have to be shared with the west as well as with the east, or with the east as well as the west. That could be. It could be because Joshua was especially closely related to the people from Manasseh, because Joshua was from Ephraim and Ephraim and Manasseh were Joseph's brothers. I think that's a stretch. I think Gill is more likely to be right that Manasseh's mentioned so that the people of Manasseh and all the people who heard this would realize Manasseh's got to split up their booty. They can't keep half for themselves on the west side. They got to give the other half to the east side as well. The spoil that they had won, a gold, bronze, iron, also included clothes. Remember, clothes were a big deal back then, a source of wealth. Don't put your treasures on earth where moth corrupts. Remember what Jesus said? Moth will destroy. That's because clothes were a form of wealth, and moths could eat wealth up. They could eat clothes up. At any rate, verse 8 ends, and Josh says, "Divide the spoil of your enemies with your brothers." In other words, the 9.5 tribes split up the plunder with the tribes on the 2.5. And of course, that would be done in an equitable fashion. Now, it could be the 2.5 tribes are exhorted here to divide their spoil with the 9.5 tribes on the west, or it could just be the half tribe of Manasseh to divide the spoil with their brothers, because Manasseh has just been mentioned singly, but I believe it's the 2.5 tribes. Divvy it up. Now, I just read verse 8 in a way that was natural to me, but there's some other options. Divide the spoil of your enemies with your brothers. That could be Joshua telling Manasseh to divide their spoil with Reuben and Gad, the other two tribes on the east side of the Jordan. It could be that Joshua is telling the 2.5 tribes to divide their spoil with the brothers who were left behind on the east of the Jordan. Remember, because not all of the tribes of Reuben, Gad, and half Manasseh went west over the Jordan. They had to leave some behind to protect the women and children. And so some people speculate this could mean that the 2.5 tribes need to share their spoil with the tribes that were left behind and who didn't fight, kind of like a baseball team has World Series shares and they give it to the trainers and to the clubhouse managers and people like that. They didn't actually play the game, but they were necessary to win the battle. Well, that could be. Some have speculated that it could be the Reuben and Gad need to share their spoils with Eastern Manasseh. I don't know. It just makes more sense to me that says, hey, 2.5 tribes, divide the spoil with the 9.5 tribes on the west. Now we go to Joshua 22, verses 9 and 10. The sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh returned home and departed from the sons of Israel at Shiloh, which is in the land of Canaan, to go to the land of Gilead, to the land of their possession which they had possessed, according to the command of the Lord through Moses. When they came to the region of the Jordan, which is in the land of Canaan, the sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh built an altar there by the Jordan, a large altar in appearance. Now, verse 9 says that the 2.5 tribes went home. They returned home. That means they returned to their camps to get their provisions before setting out for the east. It doesn't mean their final home. It means their temporary home in the west. And then they departed. And they were at Shiloh, of course, which is where the division of the last 7 tribes had taken place. And the Levites got their portion there at Shiloh. So that was the last place we left the Israelites. And they went. They were planning to go to the land of Gilead, which is the eastern side of the Jordan River. And it's a fuzzy term. It just means basically the whole country on the east side of the Jordan, as Gil says, was larger than just Gilead proper. These geographical names, of course, are sometimes fuzzy. It's even modern names are, too, a lot of times. The last part of verse 9 says they were to go to the land of their possession, which they had possessed, according to the command of the Lord through Moses. And John Gill says of this, Moses, it seems, consulted the Lord about it, who declared it to be his will that they should have it on performing what they had promised. That's in Numbers 32, which we've already talked about. This is where we first hear of this deal that the 2.5 tribes made with Moses. Now they went in verse 10 to the region of the Jordan. The NASB has it. The NIV has it. To the Gelioth near the Jordan. So the NIV takes the Hebrew there to be a place name. Gelioth means banks or sand heaps near the Jordan. Well, they went by the Jordan. Now, I've got a lot of notes here over a tempest in a teapot. I'm going to try to summarize them so I won't bore you. There's a problem there with verse 10. They built an altar there by the Jordan. Is it on the east side of the Jordan or is it on the west side of the Jordan? Well, I think it's on the west side. Why does it matter? Well, I'll show you in just a minute. There's some slight significance to it. All right, well, here's the arguments that the altar was built on the east side of the Jordan. First of all, it's more likely they would build on the east side because they own the east side. The 2.5 tribes did. They had no right to build an altar anywhere else on the west side, so it makes sense that they built on the east side. Second argument is, and I think this is a weak one, but the second argument is that the 9.5 tribes fear, which they exhibited when they went running over there to see what this altar was all about, it would make no sense if the altar was on the west. So the argument goes, it would make more sense if the Israelites were making a claim on the east side, because the western Israelites wouldn't worry about them making a claim on the western side, because it was obvious who was in control of the land. So the western Israelites would say, hey, you eastern Israelites are trying to set up worship to God on the east side, separate from the land of Israel. Well, I don't like that argument. It seems to me that if they put it on the western side, that would be a direct in-your-face challenge to the western Israelites, and that would be enough to make them mad to come over there to see what's going on. So I think that's a weak argument. A third argument that the altar was on the east side is that if the altar was on the western side, the 9.5 tribes would probably have seen it before it was built. They would have seen what was going on. But here it's clear they found out about it only after it was built, which is more likely if the altar was across the Jordan in the east. Well, here's the arguments that it's on the west side of the west side of the Jordan. First of all, as I just mentioned, the west side of the Jordan would be an area that the 9.5 tribes felt was theirs, and all of a sudden they say, whoa, we're being encroached upon. Another argument is some of the translations make it sound very much like the altar was built on the west side. Joshua 22:11 in the NASB. And the sons of Israel heard it and said, behold, the sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh have built an altar at the frontier of the land of Canaan on the side belonging to the sons of Israel. Well, the side belonging to the sons of Israel, of course, is the west side. Well, enough of that. That's, like I say, a tempest in a teapot. This altar in verse 10 was said to be very large, so it could be seen at a great distance, elevated to a great height. As Clark says, and Clark and Jameson Fawcett Brown say, it was built on an immense pile of stones and earth. Now, I don't know how they know that, but they claim that. Which I think is kind of interesting, because later we'll see that this altar is supposed to be a copy of the original altar, the one in front of the tabernacle. And that altar is specifically said, if I recall correctly, in the law, it could not be built on a big pile of stones. to make some idol out of it. But anyway, we go down to Joshua 22, verses 11 and 12. And the sons of Israel heard it, said, Behold, the sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh have built an altar at the frontier of the land of Canaan in the region of the Jordan on the side belonging to the sons of Israel. When the sons of Israel heard of it, the whole congregation of the sons of Israel gathered themselves at Shiloh to go up against them in war. Now the sons of Israel there, that phrase there is talking about the 9.5 tribe, even though the 2.5 tribes were themselves also sons of Israel, but you can tell from the context this is the 9.5 tribes talking about the 2.5 tribes. Now I've already mentioned the discussion about what side of the river the altar was on. Let me give you some other translations. The NASB makes it clear that it's on the west side, but the KJV says, at the passage of the children of Israel. Well, that doesn't really tell you anything, does it? The Green's literal translation says, and the sons of Israel heard it, said, Behold, the sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh have built an altar across from the land of Canaan. Across from the land of Canaan. Well, that sounds like it's on the east side. The American Standard Version and the English Revised Version says they built the altar on the side that pertaineth to the children of Israel, whatever that means. The NIV and the Holman Christian Study Bible says on the Israelite side, which sounds like the west side. Let's see how the Amplified does it. And the other Israelites heard it, said, Behold, the Reubenites, Gadites, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, have built an altar in the region west of the Jordan in the passage belonging to us. West of the Jordan and the passage belonging to us, so that puts it on the west side. Now, of course, west and belonging to us is in brackets, which means the Amplified interpreted this for us. But they are of the opinion that the altar was on the west side. The New Living Bible says, When the rest of Israel heard that they had built the altar at Geliloth, west of the Jordan River, in the land of Canaan, they put it clearly on the west side. The English Revised Version and the Revised Standard Version say on the side that belongs to the people of Israel, which of course would be on the west side. So I think the preponderance of authority has the altar on the west side. And verse 12, when the sons of Israel heard of the altar, the whole congregation of the sons of Israel gathered themselves at Shiloh. The Shiloh, of course, is where they are in Manasseh, northern part of Manasseh. Why were they there? Well, the tent of meeting was there. They could consult the Urim and Thurman if necessary. Should we go and fight the eastern Israelites, or should we stay home? Let's consult the Urim and the Thurman. Possibly. Now, when it says the whole congregation, it means, of course, the leaders of the congregation, not every individual. That would be a mob, uncontrollable mob. Now, they want to go to war, verse 12. They said they gathered themselves to go up against the eastern tribes in war. That's serious business. But it was actually required by the law to attack apostates, as John Gill points out, Deuteronomy 13, 12 through 16. If you hear in one of your cities, which the Lord your God is giving you to live in, anyone saying that some worthless men have gone out from among you and have seduced the inhabitants of their city, saying, Let us go and serve other gods whom you have not known, and that's what the Western Israelites thought. They thought that another altar to be set up to another god was being set up. That's why they were so upset. It wasn't really that they were losing their territory. It was that there was another god competing with Yahweh. They thought there was religious apostasy in the camp. Verse 14, Deuteronomy 13, Then you shall investigate and search out and inquire thoroughly. If it is true, and the matter established that this abomination has been done among you, you shall surely strike the inhabitants of that city with the edge of the sword, utterly destroying it, and all that is in it, and its cattle with the edge of the sword. Then you shall gather all its booty into the middle of its open square, and burn the city and all its booty with fire as a whole burnt offering to the Lord your God, and it shall be a ruin forever. It shall never be rebuilt. So the law said, take care of these apostate cities, and so the Israelites were doing their duty, the Western Israelites, the 9.5 tribes. They were horrified at the breaking up of the divine unity of Israel, which is a big deal. It was legal. Leviticus 17, 8 through 9. Then you shall say to them, Any man from the house of Israel, this is God telling Moses, say to them, Any man from the house of Israel or from the aliens who sojourn among them, who offers a burnt offering or sacrifice and does not bring it to the doorway of the tent of meeting to offer it to the Lord, that man also shall be cut off from his people. In other words, you sacrifice at the altar, at the tabernacle, later on in Jerusalem. You sacrifice where God has set up his one place of sacrifice. because otherwise you're going to be scattered all over the place making sacrifices to idols, and God's not going to put up with that. So if you sacrificed at the wrong place, the penalty was being cut off, which is probably death. Could be exile, but it's probably death. Let's read another passage in the law which talks about what a big deal it is to sacrifice on one altar, not two, but one. Deuteronomy 12:5-13, "But you shall seek the Lord at the place which the Lord your God will choose from all your tribes," and of course that later was Jerusalem, "to establish his name there for his dwelling, and there you shall come. There you shall bring your burnt offerings, your sacrifices, your tithes, the contribution of your hand, your votive offerings, your freewill offerings, and the firstborn of your herd and of your flock. There also you and your household shall eat before the Lord your God, and rejoice in all your undertakings in which the Lord your God has blessed you. You shall not do at all what we're doing here today, every man doing whatever is right in his own eyes, for you have not as yet come to the resting place and the inheritance which the Lord your God has given you." This is before the conquest of Canaan. "When you cross the Jordan and live in the land which the Lord your God has given you to inherit, and he gives you rest from all your enemies around you so that you live in security, then it shall come about that the place in which the Lord your God will choose for his name to dwell," that's Jerusalem, "there you shall bring all that I command you, your burnt offerings and your sacrifices, your tithes and the contribution of your hand, and all your choice votive offerings which you will vow to the Lord. And you shall rejoice before the Lord your God, you and your sons and daughters, your male and female servants, and the Levite who is within your gates, since he has no portion or inheritance with you." Now, the key verse here is verse 13 of Deuteronomy 12. "Be careful that you do not offer your burnt offerings in every cultic place you see." And that's what the Western Israelites thought the Eastern Israelites were getting ready to do, to offer their burnt offerings in another cultic place besides Jerusalem. We go now to Joshua 22:13-14. "Then the sons of Israel sent to the sons of Reuben, and to the sons of Gad, and to the half-tribe of Manasseh, into the land of Gilead, Phinehas, the son of Eleazar the priest, and with him 10 chiefs, 1 chief for each father's household from each of the tribes of Israel, and each one of them was the head of his father's household among the thousands of Israel." So those 10 tribal leaders were of the 9.5 tribes, which rounded off as 10. You got one leader for each tribe. They went, and also this gentleman named Phinehas. He's the son of Eleazar. Of course, Eleazar, by the way, is Aaron's oldest surviving son, Nadab and Abihu, having offered strange fire and gotten toasted by the Lord and executed because of their carelessness. Eleazar's been the high priest for quite a while now, ever since Aaron died at Mount Hor, before the sons of Israel even made it into the plains of Moab. And Phinehas is his oldest son. If you recall the story of Phinehas, he was the guy who was zealous for the Lord when the Israelites started to be seduced by the Midianites. The Midianites were in alliance with the Moabites in Moab as the Israelites were getting ready to cross over. And so the Israelites started to have a bunch of sex with the Midianite women. It was probably religious sex. And one of the Israelites, he was a leader named Zimri, he was getting it on with a Midianite woman named Cozbi, and Phinehas goes into their tent and spears them because there was a plague running through the Israelites. Already 24,000 had died by the time Phinehas speared the two. And I like to tell the story that they were in flagrante delicto. They were getting it on, and then they were pierced by a sword like a shish kebab. Well, anyway, that story is in Numbers 25:7-13. Verse 11 of that passage says, "Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, has turned away my wrath. Therefore I say, behold, I give him my covenant of peace, and it shall be for him and his descendants after him a covenant of perpetual priesthood." One last note of this section, verse 14. The representatives of the western 9.5 tribes that went over with Phinehas are said to be the head of his father's household among the thousands of Israel. That's a little bit ambiguous. If you recall, Israel was divided up into tens, fifties, hundreds, and thousands. We see that in Exodus 18:25. Tens, fifties, hundreds, and thousands, over whom there were distinct rulers, so the rulers of thousands were in each tribe. Now, you could say that the 10 rulers of the thousands that went over were the 10 tribal princes that were head over the whole tribe, and they happened to also be a ruler of their particular thousand. Colin Delitzsch disagrees with that, and he says, no, they were the leaders of thousands, and these people were different than the tribal princes, the tribal leaders. Although I can't imagine why they wouldn't send the tribal leaders over there. It seems like you'd send the big dogs over to talk to the eastern 2.5 tribes. I mean, they were getting ready for war. Why not send the leaders? So I don't know if Kyle Adelich is right about that. It's a minor point, really. Now, the nice thing about the 9.5 tribes is they sent people over to powwow. They didn't just go attack them. They went to find out what's going on. They got the facts first. Oh, boy, is that not a good application for present-day Christians. Find out what you're getting ready to get yourself into before you make an attack, because I'm telling you, it often occurs. I've had some bad experience with this. I make an accusation and find out, oh my gosh, things were not quite as I thought. That's why I believe in courts of law, to hear both sides of an issue, not to have things tried in the press, like, oh, there was corruption in the last election. Well, we're not going to talk about it. Well, the press won't try it. The courts won't try it. Therefore, I don't know, because I want to see evidence cross-examined. And that's what these people did. They went over the Western tribes to find out what was going on. That was actually required. They were required to do that by law. Deuteronomy 13:14, you shall investigate and search out and inquire thoroughly if it is true in the matter established that this abomination has been done among you. And of course, that was referring to you should investigate to see if there's any apostasy going on or idolatry going on. Now, there were 10 heads of thousands sent over, one for each of the 9.5 tribes. And then, of course, Phinehas himself went. He represented the Levites. So everybody's represented as they go over there. We go down to Joshua 22, verses 15 through 18. They came to the sons of Reuben and to the sons of Gad and to the half-tribe of Manasseh, to the land of Gilead, and they spoke with them, saying, thus says the whole congregation of the Lord. Now, they remember that you got 11 representatives, 10 heads of thousands for each of the 9.5 tribes, and Phinehas. And they say that we are the whole congregation of the Lord. What is this unfaithful act which you have committed against the God of Israel, turning away from following the Lord this day, by building yourselves an altar to rebel against the Lord this day? Is not the iniquity of Peor enough for us, from which we have not cleansed ourselves to this day, although a plague came on the congregation of the Lord, that you must turn away this day from following the Lord? If you rebel against the Lord today, he will be angry with the whole congregation of Israel tomorrow. Now, the they that are speaking to the 2.5 tribes is probably Phinehas. He's probably the spokesman. That makes sense. You notice he says that we all of us representatives, speak for the whole congregation of the Lord, as opposed to the congregation of Israel. They wanted to emphasize that they were representing God, not themselves. And they wanted to question whether the 2.5 tribes were actually representing God or themselves. In other words, they appealed from a high platform. We're standing for God here. Who do you stand for? Now, I've just finished praising the Western 9.5 tribes for giving the 2.5 tribes a chance to explain themselves. But I will note here that the Western tribes assumed that the Eastern tribes were guilty without weighing the evidence. They said, what is this unfaithful act which you have committed? They just said, you're guilty. I don't think that was so good. Perhaps their zeal for God made them a little too accusatory. Phinehas is known for his zeal. He gets up and stabs people who are having illicit, idolatrous sex. Maybe he was just a little bit too hot to go after the 2.5 tribes. John Gill says that the 9.5 tribes should have asked first whether a trespass had been committed. And I think he's right. They accused the Western tribes accused the Eastern tribes of an unfaithful act in verse 16, and also that they rebelled against the Lord. Now, to rebel against the God who had so recently delivered them was a very, very serious charge, of course. Phinehas likens this alleged idolatry to be similar to the sin of Baal of Peor. Verse 17, he says, is not the iniquity, it doesn't say Baal, he says, is not the iniquity of Peor enough for us? He's referring to Baal Peor. Peor was a mountain in the plains of Moab there at the west eastern side of the Dead Sea, the northern tip of it, right around in that area. And that was where Eleazar had stabbed Zimri and Cosby in their tent while they were having sex together. So naturally, Phinehas would have to bring that up. His zealotry for the Lord in that instance had stopped the curse of God in that instance of idolatry. And the sin of Peor had taken place on the east side of the Jordan. And that's where the eastern tribes are going, right back to their old stomping places. Let me read you Numbers 25, 2 through 3, where this incident is mentioned. For they invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. So Israel joined themselves to Baal of Peor, and the Lord was angry against Israel. And again, Peor is the mountain where there was Baal worship on that mountain. Now, Phinehas continues, probably Phinehas, and he says, hey, we're not even cleansed from the sin of Baal Peor yet. Now, what does that mean? It could mean that the Israelites were not cleared yet from the shame and disgrace of what they had done. They were still feeling guilty about it. Or it could be they're not cleared from the guilt of it because God would be watching them and he would renew the punishment, the plague, when like crimes of idolatry occurred later. This is John Gill's idea. We're not cleared yet. We're not out of this. We're not out of the woods yet. God's still going to be testing us in the matter of idolatry. Or it could mean that Phinehas is referring to individuals within Israel who were still committing idolatry, secretly, I guess, privately. But whatever it is, it's kind of interesting. After the 7 years of victory, they still had a concern against idolatry, about idolatry, whether it was still going on or it might happen in the future. I'm not sure. Phinehas mentions the fact that a plague had come on the congregation of the Lord, and that plague had not succeeded in cleansing them from the guilt or the shame of the idolatry. That plague was bad. 24,000 people, they were dying like flies until Phinehas stabbed Zimri and Cosby to stop the plague. So Phinehas is saying, look, you people saw that 24,000 people paid for idolatry with their deaths, yet you're still stupid enough to go out here and commit idolatry again. Of course, they weren't committing adultery, but Phinehas thought they were. And Phinehas says, if you don't stop this, God's going to be angry with the whole congregation of Israel tomorrow, which showed the organic unity between the 2.5 eastern tribes and the 9.5 western tribes. Phinehas and his friends had a personal stake in what the 2.5 tribes did, even though they lived on the west. This shows the organic unity of Israel. What happens on the east affects us on the west, because we are one. We go now to Joshua 22, verse 19. If, however, the land of your possession is unclean, then cross into the land of the possession of the Lord, where the Lord's tabernacle stands, and take possession among us. Only do not rebel against the Lord or rebel against us by building an altar for yourselves besides the altar of the Lord our God. The reason that Phinehas mentions that the land of your possession is unclean, he's saying, look, if you build an altar, you must think where you're living is unclean. You're trying to clean it, trying to make it undefiled. Well, there's no need to, he says. Why might they think it was defiled? Well, because the eastern land was allegedly not originally included in the covenant of Abraham and the Mosaic covenant. But I take question on that, because the land, as we've seen in the prophecies, the promised land extended from the river Euphrates to the Wadi El Arish on the Egyptian border, and where the eastern tribes were standing was within that geographical compass. So I don't know why they would think the land is unclean. It was part of the promised land. But Phinehas thought they might have thought that it was, so. And Phinehas was very, again, I'm assuming it's Phinehas talking here. It might not be. Doesn't explicitly say so. But he says, hey, come live among us. Now, how generous that was. Instead of going to war, they were willing to part with some of their land. As John Gill says, quote, even though they straightened themselves and parted with much of their estates, rather than they should make a schism or go into idolatrous practices, which was a brave, noble spirit indeed, and showed their great concern for the honor and glory of God and his worship, and their love to their brethren, and affectionate regard for their spiritual welfare above their own private, personal, and temporal good. Notice in verse 19 here that Phinehas says, do not rebel against the Lord or rebel against us. Notice that Lord and us are parallel. Don't rebel against either one of us, because Phinehas was so certain that he was standing for the Lord's honor. He identified himself with the Lord. You rebel against us, you're rebelling against God. I like that confidence. That Phinehas was something else. We go down to Joshua 22, verse 20. Phinehas continues, did not Achan the son of Zerah act unfaithfully in the things under the ban, and wrath fall on all the congregation of Israel? And that man did not perish alone in his iniquity. Of course, that's referring to the second city that the Israelites conquered 7 years previous when they crossed the Jordan River. They had just conquered Jericho. They were going to get Ai, but Achan had taken some of the spoils of Jericho, which were cherem, dedicated, put under the curse, anathema, dedicated to God. They were supposed to go to God, to the temple, to the treasury, or either to be burnt up. And Achan took some of that stuff and hid it under his tent, thus causing the Israelites to lose. Wrath fell. That's because they got beat as they tried to attack Ai. Achan did not perish alone. What does that mean? Well, it could mean that The Israelites lost 36 of their men when they sent a small detachment to Ai and got beat, and they ran down the hill, and the men of Ai struck down 36 of their men, as it says in Joshua 7:5. So Ai and 36 other men died, or it could mean Ai's children were killed in addition to himself. But whatever it was serious business. People died. So, hey, 2.5 tribes on the east, maybe you better reconsider your idolatry. Actually, it was alleged idolatry, which was not actually idolatry. We go now to verses 21 through 23 of Joshua 22. Then the sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh answered and spoke to the heads of the families of Israel. The mighty one, God the Lord. The mighty one, God the Lord. Now that, even in English, even in the English translation, you can see, man, they are serious here. We are following Yahweh. We are not idolaters. He, that's the mighty one, the God, the Lord, he knows, and may Israel itself know, if it was in rebellion or if in an unfaithful act against the Lord, do not save us this day. If we have built us an altar to turn away from following the Lord, or if to offer a burnt offering or grain offering on it, or if to offer sacrifices of peace offerings on it, may the Lord himself require it. Well, there's your denial. Now, here's a good quote from one of my authors, is probably John Gill. He says this, though conscious of their own innocency, they, that's the 2.5 tribes, permitted Phinehas to finish his discourse. Though composed of little else than accusations, there was a decency in this, and such a full proof of good breeding, as does them the highest credit. There are many public assemblies in the present day which lay claim to the highest refinement, who might take a very useful lesson from these Reubenites and their associates. They sat there and let the accusations rain that on their head, and they didn't say anything. They did not interrupt. They just listened. Yeah, maybe the United States Congress could learn from this. Now, that phrase that they used when they finally did respond was the mighty one, God the Lord. In Hebrew, that's El, Elohim, Yehovah. Or actually, it's an English translation of the three Hebrew words, El, Elohim, Yahweh. Adam Clark says these are the three principal names by which the supreme God was known among the Hebrews. And maybe thus translated, the strong God. I like that, the strong God. NASB has the mighty one. Elohim, which is normally translated God. That's the general word for God. And then the special name for God is Yahweh, the Lord, L-O-R-D, or sometimes Jehovah, but I don't like Jehovah. I like Yahweh better. And Adam Clark says, by using these in their very solemn appeal, expressed at once their strong, unshaken faith in the God of Israel, and by this they fully showed the deputation from the 10 tribes that their religious creed had not been changed. Homer Christian Southern Bible translates that as, Yahweh is the God of gods. Yahweh is the God of gods. I'm not sure which one I like better, the mighty one, God the Lord, or Yahweh is the God of gods. Either way, we get the idea. He knows, say the 2.5 tribes. As John Gill says, the omniscient God, the searcher of the hearts and the trier of the reins of the children of men, he knows our cordial belief of this truth, the integrity of our hearts, the intention of our minds, that we never had a thought in us of departing from his worship, as Gill puts words into the mouths of the 2.5 tribes of the east. And they said, if we were doing idolatry, may God himself require it. The Holman Christian Study Bible has, may God hold us accountable. It's a little bit better English. Now, how could God hold them accountable? Well, perhaps Phinehas and the 10 leaders of the thousands kill the 2.5, the leaders of the 2.5 tribes. Or it could be, what they meant to say was, let the 9.5 tribes on the west wage war against us 2.5 tribes on the east and kill us all. That's sort of like an oath. We go now to verses 24 and 25 of Joshua 22. But truly we have done this out of concern for a reason, continue the 2.5 tribes, saying, in time to come your sons may say to our sons, your sons of the 9.5 tribes on the west may say to our sons, our descendants of the 2.5 tribes on the east, what have you to do with the Lord, the God of Israel? For the Lord has made the Jordan a border between us and you, you sons of Reuben and sons of Gad. You have no portion in the Lord. So your sons may make our sons stop fearing the Lord. Now these concerns that the 2.5 tribes might be forgotten because of that border of the Jordan River, those concerns probably got larger and larger as they got further and further away from the 9.5 tribes. A question I have is, were their concerns reasonable? In my opinion, they were reasonable. First of all, they didn't disobey the law, the laws that I just quoted from Deuteronomy, that the worship was to be in one place, because they had no intention of offering sacrifices on this memorial altar, as we'll see in just a minute. Now, you could say that they were not reasonable because by setting up such an altar, they were establishing something that could be easily abused. It would be very easy later on to start offering sacrifices, even though there was no intention at first. Well, you can always, that's a thin edge of the wedge argument, you can always say, hey, you shouldn't do that because it can be abused. The problem with that is everything can be abused. So that means that nothing would be permissible. So I think the 2.5 tribes comported themselves quite well here. Now, they did say that the Lord has made the Jordan a border between us and you. That's not precisely true, as John Gill points out. Quote, not that this was really the case, but so they feared it would be represented in time to come. For though Jordan was the border of the land of Canaan, strictly so called, eastward, yet it did not exclude the land of the 2.5 tribes from being part of the land of promise. For the Amorites, which before inhabited it and were driven out of it, were Canaanites and were one part of the people whose land the Lord promised to Abraham. Well, the Canaanites were unity crossing that Jordan River, but also the land itself. The promised land was all the way from the Euphrates down to the Wadi El Arish, Genesis 15:18-21. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your descendants I have given this land from the river of Egypt, that's the Wadi El Arish, as far as the great river, the river Euphrates. So there you have it. The 2.5 tribes were not quite precisely accurate when they said that the Lord made the Jordan a border between us and you. Now, it could psychologically be a border. As it is, even as I look at a map, I always have a border. I keep thinking the land of Israel is to the west of the Jordan. You just can't help it. But God never made it a border. So in verse 25, the 2.5 tribes are quoting hypothetical sons who are saying, hypothetical sons of the 9.5 tribes in the west saying, hey, you sons of Reuben and sons of Gad, you have no portion in the Lord. They didn't mention you sons of Manasseh, Reuben, and Gad, probably because Manasseh is on the west and people are not going to forget the Manassehites. We go now to Joshua chapter 22, verses 26 through 29. Therefore we, Eastern Israelites, Reuben, Gad, and half Manasseh said, let us build an altar, not for burnt offering or for sacrifice. Rather, it shall be a witness between us and you and between our generations after us that we are to perform the service of the Lord before him with our burnt offerings and with our sacrifices and with our peace offerings, so that your sons will not say to our sons in times to come, you have no portion in the Lord. Sons, of course, means descendants. Therefore, we said, it shall also come about that if they say this to us or to our generations in time to come, then we shall say, see, the copy of the altar of the Lord which our fathers made, not for burnt offering or for sacrifice, rather it is a witness between us and you. Far be it from us that we should rebel against the Lord and turn away from following the Lord this day by building an altar for burnt offering, for grain offering, or for sacrifice, besides the altar of the Lord our God which is before his tabernacle. So basically the 2.5 tribes say we're not going to burn any sacrifices on it, so we're not breaking the Levitical law, which says there will be a unified altar in Jerusalem, or the place that the God chooses for that altar, which turned out to be Jerusalem. Now this altar was a copy. John Gill says this, quote, the pattern of the altar of the Lord, which our fathers made, which exactly agrees with the Mosaic altar, and which they could never have framed in so exact a manner if they had not seen it and served in it. Wherefore, this was a plain proof of their being originally worshippers of the same God, partakers of the same altar, and were in the faith, fellowship, and communion of Israel. In other words, if we make an altar that looks just like the altar in Jerusalem, and years later our descendants look at the altar here on the side of the Jordan River, whichever side it was, they look at that altar and they say, hey, this altar is exactly like the altar that's down in Jerusalem. These people must be of the same people, of the same kindred. Joshua 22, verses 30 through 34. So when Phinehas the priest and the leaders of the congregation, even the heads of the families of Israel who were with him, heard the words which the sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad and the sons of Manasseh spoke, it pleased them. And Phinehas the son of Eleazar the priest said to the sons of Reuben and to the sons of Gad and to the sons of Manasseh, today we know that the Lord is in our midst, because you have not committed this unfaithful act against the Lord. Now you have delivered the sons of Israel from the hand of the Lord. Well, let's stop right there. Delivered how? Well, it could be from God's punishment. Had there been an actual trespass against the unity of Israel, and had that altar been an altar of sacrifice, God would have punished them all. Or it could be they were delivered from a fratricidal war, which would be the hand of the Lord also. Either way, the punishment would have been bad business. Verse 32, Joshua 22. Then Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the priest, and the leaders returned from the sons of Reuben and from the sons of Gad, from the land of Gilead to the land of Canaan, to the sons of Israel, back to Shiloh, in other words, and brought back word to them. The word pleased the sons of Israel, and the sons of Israel blessed God. And that's, now the sons of Israel there is talking about the 9.5 tribes. And they did not speak of going up against them in war to destroy the land in which the sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad were living. The sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad called the altar Witness, capital W in the NESB, Witness. For, they said, it is a witness between us that the Lord is God. By the way, I just said the sons of Israel is talking about the 9.5 tribes. It is, but verse 31, it's probably all of the sons of Israel. Now you, the 2.5 tribes, have delivered the sons of Israel from the hand of the Lord. That would be all of them, not just the 9.5 tribes. Ladies and gentlemen, one more comment and we'll be finished with this chapter. The fact that they use the phrase, that Phinehas uses the phrase sons of Israel, this shows the organic unity of Israel. The actions of one part of an organic whole will affect the actions of another part. In other words, the sons of Israel will all suffer from the hand of the Lord if this altar is not taken down. I mean, the 9.5 tribes could just say, okay, fine, go your way. Go to the east of Jordan, do your own thing. We'll be faithful to the Lord over here on the west. But it didn't work that way because they were all one. That idea of those 12 tribes being one nation under God, one nation was so strong that it could not be tolerated that 2.5 of those tribes would deviate from the true path. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished Joshua chapter 22. That prepares us now for the next audio to go into chapter 23. Chapter 23 consists of Joshua's charge to Israel's leaders as he gets ready to go to the afterlife. So I hope you stay tuned for chapter 23, and I hope you enjoyed this discussion of chapter 22.